This is Geology Bites with Oliver Strumpel. The word volcano conjures up an image of a peak with a crater at the top. We hear about them when dramatic explosions occur. But actually, volcanoes come in many different shapes, and their eruptions may not be explosive at all. Furthermore, volcanism is not confined to the Earth. David Rothery is Professor of Planetary Geosciences at The Open University. He's an expert in the study of volcanic activity using satellite remote sensing and investigates volcanism throughout the solar system. David Rothery, welcome to Geology Bites.
Thank you, Oliver. It's very nice to talk with you.
I said that volcanoes make us think of mountains with sharp peaks and craters. But that's not always the case, is it?
Well, no, that's the picture book idea of a volcano, and it's true in some cases, but they're not all steep-sided, they're not all symmetrical, and some of the greatest volumes of volcanic products spread out horizontally without ever building up to form any kind of mountain.
Can you give us some examples of each of these different kinds of volcano?
Okay, I mean, your classic conical volcano is something like Mount Fuji in Japan, or many of the Andes, or the Cascades volcanoes in the northwestern United States. But if you go to somewhere like Hawaii, where what's erupted is a rock type called basalt, which is rather fluid, the volcanoes don't build up to anything like such a steep cone, but they can be very, very large conical edifices. And then elsewhere, the even greater volumes of lavas can produce flood basalts, like the Columbia River basalts in the Washington State, or the Deccan Traps in India, where flows are spread horizontally for hundreds of kilometres. These are not active today, thank goodness, because they would make a hell of a mess of the climate, but lava spreads a long, long way sideways if it's erupted violently enough in sufficient volumes.
Is there a basic reason why some lavas are very sticky and make pointy mountains and others are very runny and just create these very extensive flows?
There are two main factors. One is the stickiness, as you put it, or viscosity of the lava. Lava that doesn't flow very freely is richer in silica, that silicon dioxide, than the runnier, the lower viscosity kinds of lava. And magma that comes pretty much directly from the Earth's mantle is of a rock type we call basalt, and this is low viscosity and flows relatively freely. If this magma on the way up is stored somewhere and cools down slowly enough and some crystals can separate from it, what you've got left is richer in silica, and when it oozes out at the surface, it's much more viscous, much more sticky, it doesn't flow so freely, and so it won't travel so far, so we'll build up into a bigger, taller pile. But on top of that, as magma does this fractional crystallization, any gases that were within the original magma are concentrated into the remaining part of the melt. And when the gas-rich magma nears the surface, the gas can come out of solution violently enough to drive an explosion. And instead of gooey lava oozing out, you get an explosion sending out a vertical jet of fragmental material, which will then fall back down on the mountain. And the combination of explosive eruptions producing large volumes of ash to settle on the mountain or to cascade down in pyroclastic flows with sticky lavas, high viscosity lavas, is what builds up your classical Mount Fuji type conical volcano. So it's a complex series of events to give a picture book kind of steep conical volcano.
As I mentioned, volcanism is not confined to the Earth. So where else do we have active volcanoes today?
Depends how you define volcanism, but if you want silicates, if you want rock erupting on the surface of a body, the only other example for sure is Jupiter's innermost large moon, which is called Io. And Io has dozens of volcanoes erupting all the time. You can see them with infrared telescopes from the Earth, but they weren't suspected until space probe Voyager 1 flew past, I think it was 1979, and it found these eruption plumes, because explosive eruptions are the easiest ones to spot, and plumes of fragmental material being thrown 200 kilometres above the surface were witnessed by Voyager, and several spacecraft since then have seen these. So we've got lava flows on the surface and eruptions into a vacuum of an explosive nature on Io. If you're willing to regard eruptions involving molten ice, which is water but not necessarily just pure water, as an example of volcanism. You can go to Enceladus, an inner moon of Saturn, a much smaller body than Io, where there are plumes of water ice crystals being jetted into space. Now, it's a matter of semantics whether you regard that more akin to geysering than to proper volcanism, but certainly that brings us into the realms of cryovolcanism, because we might talk about this later. Mixtures of ices behave very much like mixtures of silicate minerals, so icy volcanism and silicate volcanism have many, many close parallels. So that's two places in the solar system, Io and Enceladus, where you can see volcanism active today.
So we have these two kinds of volcanism, silicate volcanism and then cryovolcanism, which involves ice. So are those similar to each other?
In some respects, yes. If you talk about melting a mixture of silicate minerals, when rock inside the Earth is caused to melt, it's usually because of a change of pressure rather than because it's warmed up. But whatever process that causes it to melt, it doesn't all melt at once, because different minerals melt at different temperatures. So you get this process of partial melting, and the melt that you get out from this mixture of crystals is richer in silicon than what's left behind. So the melt is a different composition to what you began with. And that process of partial melting is exactly what goes on when you melt ice, unless it's pure H2O, pure water ice. If you've got any kind of mixture of H2O and salts, or H2O and some other volatile substance such as ammonia, the ammonia water system is a perfect analogue to a mixture of two silicate minerals. When you cause it to melt, the melt composition is different to either of those end members, and it also melts at a lower temperature than either pure end member would. So you get partial melting in mixtures of ices, very, very closely analogous to partial melting in mixtures of silicates. When we come to explosive eruptions, that's where certainly the Enceladus type of cryovolcanism differs to what we see in an explosive silicate volcano on Earth, or indeed on Io. On Earth or Io, as your magma rises to the surface, there's a gas in solution. It could be water vapor, it could be carbon dioxide, it could be sulfur dioxide, or probably a mixture of all three. And as the gas nears the surface, and therefore the confining pressure decreases, the gas comes out of solution, forms bubbles. And if it forms enough bubbles quickly enough, that drives an explosion and breaks the magma apart into fragments and jets them out through the volcanic vent. Somewhere like Enceladus, what we think we've got there is not a partial melting process going on within its icy crust. We think the ice is floating on an internal ocean of liquid water. There's a global ocean under the ice on Enceladus, and there are other bodies in the solar system where there are these global oceans. So you've already got a complete melt below there. And what happens to cause an explosive eruption is not something in solution in this melt, in this water. What happens is, if the ice cracks and the water is exposed to space, the vacuum of space, there's therefore no confining pressure on the water, and the water begins to boil directly into the vacuum. So the water forms its own gas. It's not a gas dissolved in the water which comes out of solution. The water is turning to gas. So you expose some water to space in a crack in the icy crust, water vapor forms, and water is brought up to the surface by the force of these expanding bubbles, and as soon as it gets to the surface, it freezes into ice crystals. So what you see jetted to space at Enceladus is jets of ice fragments propelled by the expansion of water vapour. And it's great because the Cassini spacecraft was able to fly through those when it was orbiting Saturn and detect other stuff there, like methane and tiny silica particles and even atomic hydrogen and various organic molecules as well. So we've got all kinds of measures of what's going on in Enceladus's ocean carried out to space, where we can sample it by these expanding plumes. But these plumes are not that analogous to volcanic plumes on the Earth, A, because they're into a vacuum, and B, because of how you get the gas in the first place.
On Earth, the volcanism above subduction zones is a direct result of plate tectonics. I mean, that would create volcanoes like Fuji, for example. And the other kind of volcanism, such as in Hawaii, say, is caused by mantle convection. Do we think these processes are actually going on today on Io and Enceladus?
I would leave Enceladus aside. You've got a global ice layer floating around on a global internal ocean. No movement is causing the melting. You've got a continuous molten layer below. But on Io, it's probably rather analogous to the Hawaii situation, where we've got a mantle below, which is warm, and the uprising cells in the mantle plumes, if you like. We have to be careful about the word plume, because we use it for stuff that's jetted to space and to the pipe-like upwellings within a body. Okay, so the internal mantle plumes in Io or below Hawaii on the Earth are bringing warm mantle upwards, which experiences lower pressure and begins to melt, and that feeds the volcanoes. So the Hawaii situation is rather like what's happening on Io, except Io has it in spades all over the blooming globe. What Io lacks is subduction, which is where you get volcanoes like in the Andes and in Japan, where one plate is being drawn down below another. And the cause of the melting there isn't a decrease in pressure as stuff is drawn upwards. What causes the melting is the downgoing plate has a lot of water at the surface, minerals that have been hydrated on the ocean floor, and cracks physically carrying water down. When the water gets driven off as the plate goes down into the base of the overriding plate, the addition of water causes hydration melting and produces volcanoes above this subduction zone. And those are volcanoes which are going to be richer in silica, and they're the less runny kind of lava we spoke about before, andesite in composition, which tends to be very sticky and more explosive and will build up typical conical mountains. So that type of volcano we don't see anywhere else in the solar system, because we don't have subducting slabs carrying water downwards, which is the secret to getting subduction zone volcanism.
I suppose it's pretty amazing that we actually see volcanism going on somewhere other than Earth today, but do we also see signs of past volcanism on other bodies in the solar system?
Oh yeah, pretty much everywhere you look. When you look at the moon and with the naked eye and see the dark patches on it, the lunar maria, those are flood basalts that we spoke about, like the Columbia River basalts or the Deccan Traps. 3.5 billion years ago, major impact basins on the moon were flooded by lavas. And that's probably how we formed the earliest evolved planetary crusts everywhere in the solar system. The whole of Mercury, where I'm working, was surfaced by that kind of volcanism. Probably the same happened on Mars as well, and probably also on Venus. But Venus has had a volcanic history which has gone on into the pretty recent past. It may still be active today. So the very early vast flood basalts have been overprinted by many, many generations of volcanism and resurfacing of the globe in patches many times. So the whole globe has been resurfaced and the very ancient volcanism isn't there on Venus anymore. And then we go to the moons of bodies like Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. And all the large ones are icy except for Io, the innermost large moon of Jupiter, which is tidally heated and has lost any water it used to have and just got these hot silicates erupting. But the other large moons of Jupiter, Europa and Ganymede, and possibly Callisto even further out, have zones of liquid water below the icy crust. Now, on Europa, it's close enough that water can get squeezed out as slush to the surface when the ice cracks, and then the cracked ice pushes back together and can squeeze slush out through the cracks. Ganymede, nothing like that's going on today because the ocean is too deep inside. And then we've got smaller moons like Enceladus at Saturn, where we've got the ice exposing the water to space when a crack opens and it boils away and drives out these plumes. So we've got silicate volcanism in the past on all the terrestrial planets and the moon, and today on Io. And we've got cryovolcanism. Cryo is just a Greek word for ice. Cryovolcanism going on in the past on many of the icy bodies, and on one, possibly two today. That's Enceladus and Europa.
Why did volcanism apparently shut down on the other rocky planets apart from Earth?
Well, that's a good question. You need heat inside the body to cause the convection. You're not applying heat to make the magma to melt the rock to cause it to come out. You've got more subtle processes going on, like changes of pressure or changes of hydration. But it still needs to be warm inside and churning around. And the smaller bodies have lost more of their heat because the smaller you are, the greater the ratio of your surface area to your volume. So the smaller bodies lose heat more quickly. Heat is being produced internally inside rocky bodies by radioactive decay. But everywhere has the same composition, then the rate of radioactive heat production depends on your volume, not your surface area. So the smaller bodies have cooled down more. And the exceptions are Io. Io's a moon of Jupiter, a little bit bigger than our own moon, but it's kept warm by a different process. That's tidal heating, because you've got a family of moons orbiting Jupiter in resonance, and there's repeated tidal energy being stoked into the interior of these bodies. So that's why Io's an exception. But it's easy to understand why Mars and Mercury have cooled down and are not volcanically active today. Venus is almost but not quite as big and as massive as the Earth. It doesn't have plate tectonics like the Earth because it's lost its water. And that's probably why the rigid outer shell isn't so mobile in the same way as it is on the Earth. You've got no subduction zone volcanoes. But we're not sure if Venus has finished its active volcanism. I very much doubt that it has. If you look at Venus's surface, which you have to do with radar because it's permanently cloudy, there's only been one really good mission orbiting Venus, mapping the whole globe with radar. And there are impact craters on the surface, but not so many as there would be if the surface was billions of years old. It is a relatively young surface on Venus, and everywhere you look, almost everywhere you look, is volcanic. There are shield volcanoes like Hawaii, there are some vast lava flows. So Venus has had many, many eruptions. We can't tell if any have been going on in the past century or the past million years. If I was to bet on it, there's certainly been active volcanism in the past million years on Venus. It may be going on today. There are some indications that the amount of sulfur dioxide in Venus's atmosphere has fluctuated, and that's easier to explain if Venus is volcanically active. So it wouldn't surprise me if we've got active volcanism on Venus today, but we've not had a way to spot it happening yet.
I know you're especially interested in Mercury, and you mentioned briefly that it does also have a volcanic history. Tell us a bit more about that.
Okay, well, I'm involved in the mission BepiColombo, which is a European Space Agency, Japanese Space Agency mission, now on its way to Mercury. It won't get there until December 2025, and it will take a few months before we get into our science orbit and start getting data from it. But there's been a NASA mission which orbited Mercury called MESSENGER, and that has convinced pretty much everybody that works on Mercury that it's got a very, very volcanic past. The whole of its crust pretty much was built up by volcanism. I mentioned earlier the dark patches on the moon, the lunar maria. Everywhere on Mercury began like the lunar maria. So we've got vast fields of flood basalts, which are a little bit peculiar because they're very high in magnesium and low in iron, but certainly very runny basalts. But more recently, there have been explosive eruptions which have punched holes through these basalts. So the most recent large-scale volcanism on Mercury has been explosive, which we did not expect on a planet like Mercury. It shouldn't be rich in volatile substances. It's presently close to the sun. And yet, the most recent volcanic evidence is of magmas nearing the surface, carrying a big load of volatiles, anything that will turn to gas, and puncturing these holes in the surface. And the stuff gets vented out into space, rather like the eruptions we can see on Io today, and just falls back to the surface on sort of parabolic ballistic trajectories, giving us these quite bright red-coloured patches of material. And the biggest such example on Mercury is a feature called Nater Facula. Facula is just the International Astronomical Union descriptor term for a bright spot, and the Nater is the name of this one. It's about 250 kilometres in diameter, and in the centre there's a hole in the ground that's 3.5 kilometres deep and about 30 kilometres across. It's an enormous hole blasted in the surface, probably blasted through the surface by a series of eruptions rather than a single eruption. And there are small examples of these faculae all over the globe. And it's part of the mystery of Mercury. It's clearly got volatiles, which we didn't expect on a body that close to the sun. So that's not why we're sending BepiColombo there, because BepiColombo was planned before we knew about this. But it's another good thing about BepiColombo. It will hopefully tell us what the volatiles are, which have been driving these explosive eruptions. But we don't think they're active today.
If we assume that there really are volatiles there, which it seems like we have to, do we have any ideas as to what they're doing there, how they got there?
No, we don't. But we know there are volatiles because there's several lines of evidence which are pretty much independent. I've mentioned the explosive volcanic eruptions. We've got some compositional evidence because we've measured sulfur with the X-ray spectrometer that MESSENGER had. Everywhere you look on Mercury has about 2 to 4% sulfur across the surface. Probably not existing as pure sulfur. It's sulfur compounds, calcium sulfide or magnesium sulfide, but a lot of sulfur nonetheless, a lot of potassium, a lot of chlorine, a lot of sodium. And then there are other patches on the surface which are active today, places called hollows where the top 10 or 20 metres of the surface has just been stripped away. You've got steep-sided flat bottom depressions. These are what's called hollows, which must have been volatile because the stuff has just gone. It's been turned to vapour and lost to space. We don't know how, and we don't know what the volatile substance there is. So we don't know what volatile is lost to form the hollows. We don't know what volatile is driving the explosive volcanic eruptions. But we do know there's a lot of, as I said, sulfur, chlorine, sodium and potassium. Those volatile phases are there. So we think a lot of volatile elements on Mercury. Now, how do you do that on a body that's as dense as Mercury? Because Mercury is a dense, rocky body. It's got a very large core and a comparatively thin, rocky mantle and crust on top of that. So it probably began life with a lot more rock, and the rock was stripped away violently. So you need a collision to do that, probably. So if you're colliding two bodies together and stripping away a lot of the rock, you're going to lose volatiles as well. So that deepens the mystery of Mercury. How do you have a collision stripping the rock away and leaving volatiles behind? Well, perhaps the answer to that is you start with very volatile, rich rock. So maybe, this is now answering your question, so maybe Mercury condensed, began to form much further out from the sun than we now see it. If Mercury began where Mars is, or a little bit further out from Mars, and then came inwards and careened off the early Earth or the early Venus, or one of the bodies which would shortly merge with something else to form the Earth or Venus, then this proto-Mercury could have lost most of its rock in this collision, and what was left carried on and found itself in an inner orbit close to the sun. And the rock that was left, which was not very much, still had a fair bit of volatiles in it because it began with lots of volatiles having formed further from the sun. Now, that's a very convoluted story, but it's actually the one that best fits the evidence at the moment. We'll have more confidence in this when we've measured more of the volatiles with BepiColombo in orbit around Mercury.
I just want to come back briefly to these incredible holes that you talked about. You said one of them is 3.5 kilometres deep. Does it just look like have walls around it? I mean, how rigid is this rock?
It doesn't have a rampart. The big thing about these volcanoes on Mercury is that they're not mountains. They're holes in the ground. But the steepness of the slope, the internal slopes are about 20 to 30 degrees. If you stood on the brink, it wouldn't be a cliff, but it would still be a long, long way down to the bottom. Yes, there is bedrock exposed there, but if you were walking around on the surface of Mercury, you'd be leaving footprints everywhere. Most people listening to this will have seen pictures of the Apollo astronauts walking around on the moon, leaving their boot prints. And what they're leaving the boot prints in is the regolith, the fragmental rocky material that's accumulated as a result of impacts on all sizes breaking the surface apart. Now, this regolith forms on Mercury even faster than it does on the Moon, because Mercury is closer to the Sun and the impacts are faster. So you'd be walking around on quite a powdery surface on Mercury, but it is coherent. Dust particles get welded together in a vacuum, and if there are some volatile substances which are somehow mobile through the regolith, they could stick it together as well. So you can form landscapes out of this powdery material. Impact craters survive for billions of years, and steep-sided holes in the ground, which are not impact craters, also survive for up to billions of years.
Just to explain, you mentioned that the impacts will be stronger because Mercury is closer to the sun. So I suppose when things fall in, the sun is accelerating them, and so it's deeper down the potential well. So the impacts are just going to be that much more violent. Is that right?
Well, essentially, another way to look at it is Mercury orbits the sun travelling with a faster orbital velocity than the Earth does. So anything in the path of Mercury is hit at a faster speed.
Is there a particular puzzle that you're especially looking forward to answering when Bepi Colombo finally switches its instruments on?
Yeah, we're mapping the whole of Mercury at the moment with the images from MESSENGER. And the thing that's most perplexing me is the hollows that we see here and there. I've mentioned these already, these steep-sided flat-bottom depressions. And we don't know what the heck is going on there. How are you turning stuff to vapour and letting it escape to space and then turning it off? Because the hollows grow and then they appear to stop, leaving you a big cluster of hollows. And then next door, there are no hollows. So what's going on? And if you're removing 10 or 20 metres of material, was it all volatile? Did you volatilise all of it? If not, what proportion is volatile? If it's half volatile and half just ordinary rock, if you've got a 20 metre deep depression, the floor of it must now be another 20 metres of pure rock. So you've volatilised 40 metres of material, and 20 metres at the bottom is pure residue, pure lag deposit. But how do you remove volatiles through several metres of lag? I mean, we don't know what is going on. Is it the heat from the sun? Is it the solar photons? Is it micrometeorites? Is it charged particles from the solar wind hitting the surface and breaking chemical bonds? We don't know. So we want to get compositional measurements inside a hollow and just outside of an active hollow and see what the difference is. And we'll have other instruments in space which might be able to sniff what elements are coming off from the hollows as well. So the hollow forming process, for me, is the biggest mystery on Mercury. And that's not volcanic. I've veered away from volcanism and said it's hollows that we most need to understand.
For my last question, I want to ask you, if I were to put you in charge of selecting the next science mission from the world's space agencies, what would it be?
What I'd like to do is do something which nobody else is going to do. We need a mission to Venus, and that's going to happen. I wouldn't change that. If I could have an extra one so I can find out something in my lifetime which I wouldn't otherwise, it would be to go to Miranda, which is a small moon of Uranus, which Voyager 2 flew past in the 1980s. It saw less than half of Miranda. Miranda has got oozing out of it in just a few places these very viscous, what look like cryovolcanic lava flows. We think it's probably what you get when you partially melt a mixture of H2O and ammonia. You get these viscous flows just oozing out. So how do we get these flows out to the surface? Water ice is less dense than liquid water, so you wouldn't get a water flow rising to the surface of an icy body. But if you've got the right density contrast between water ice and ammonia ice and the melt that you get from them, the melt might be buoyant enough to get to the surface, especially if you've got some rock to weigh down the ice. Well, what's going on the half of the globe of Miranda we've never seen because it was in darkness when Voyager flew by? It's a frustrating globe. It's got wonderful textures all over it. We should go there and we can study the cryovolcanism on Miranda and understand how this whole weird globe is put together. Nobody's going to do that for the next 20, 30, 40 years. So I'm not going to see Miranda's other half. So if you could give me a mission that I could snap my fingers and make happen, that's what I'd do.
David Rothery, thank you very much.
It was great talking to you, Oliver.
For more about Geology Bites, as well as pictures and diagrams that illustrate this podcast, you can go to geologybites.com.